Mexico Research Initiative 2016 conference.
Okay, I'm Kate Frazier, and I'm a postdoc at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and we're based in California, but we have the luck of coming out here to this meeting in Tampa, and it's been great so far. It's always a big family reunion to see all these people and the work they've been doing over the last 5 years. So I've been to every meeting so far, and I'm going to keep at it.
You've been funded to listen for dolphins in the Gulf of Mexico in the offshore region. Can you tell us a little bit about what's called passive acoustic monitoring?
Basically, the way it works is we have a box, and in the box, it's a maybe 4x4 cube, and in it, we have computers, basically, that are suction cup down and watertight, and they have a whole bunch of data storage and battery packs, and then there's also some flotation, and we just attach a big weight to it and drop it off the side of a boat. Literally, that's what happens. And it has a microphone that floats above it. And so it just sinks away, and then...
It's kind of like fishing.
It's like, it's a delayed gratification fishing.
Because you leave it out for months.
Yeah, for a year. Yeah, now we've got them up to over a year. They can sit on the seafloor, and they just record, I think it's 200,000 times a second. So it's outrageous, the sampling rate. And it stores all that data on board. And then what happens is, we watch our clocks, and then when it's time to go pick it up, we go back out, and we send a ping to it, a certain sequence of pings, and that tells the instrument to drop its ballast, so all those weights that were holding it down. So it goes beep, 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 and then it says okay, and it like drops the weights and floats up, and then we pick it up. That's really how it goes. Yeah. So, and it's always like a miracle that it comes back up at all.
So it's like your fish. It's like you're laying lobster traps or crab traps.
Exactly. And it comes back.
This crab trap probably costs $1 million.
Well, not quite that, but
tens of thousands.
It's an expensive piece of equipment, and we're always happy to get it back.
Yeah.
Sound is a pressure wave, right? So it's all just recording the oscillations of sound on that sensor, and then what we do is take that back home and break it down into, okay, what frequencies are contained in that sound, and based on the frequencies that are present, we can say, okay, here's a fish, he went and then we had a dolphin that went by and it clicked, and we're getting all of these, yeah, right, exactly. And so dolphin clicks are ultrasonic. You wouldn't be able to hear them, but their whistles that they use for communication, those are definitely within hearing range. And then one thing we get a lot of in the Gulf is air guns from all the oil exploration. Those kind of ricochet around the basin, and you can hear those like boom, boom, as every time they're, they're out there looking for oil.
If you're a sperm whale
in the Gulf, you need some earplugs.
It's a big concussive blast that creates a cavitation.
Right. And they use the echo to learn about the substrate, the seafloor.
Right. So you hear that too.
So you get all of it. You get really, it's a very rich data set, I guess, to the high. I've focused in on species that have characteristic clicks. They use these echolocation clicks. It's like a beam of sound that comes out of their forehead, and it bounces off of something and comes back. And based on how fast it comes back and what frequencies come back, they can tell, what's in front of them and whether it's good to eat, that kind of thing. But it's like a laser, literally. Like, it's very directional sound. And so you...
A hunting scope.
It totally is. Yeah, it's their hunting scope, and it works really well. And so we get that sound if the animal's pointing at or sort of in the direction of the sensor, and we don't get it if they're close but pointing away, right? So it's a really directional beam. But fortunately, dolphins like to swim together, and so, odds are somebody's going to point our direction, and we'll...
You hear a lot more of these dolphins than you see. With the limited amount, people are able to get out on boats to look for them.
Yeah. 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 Because if you think about going out on a big cruise, one of these big cruises that goes out and looks for whales visually, you're talking $50,000 a day to do that. And they're dependent on weather. If it's bad weather, everybody just goes in their bunk and sleeps it off, right?
And they're under the water.
Animals aren't. Well, dolphins, they don't dive very deep. Dives are about 5 minutes max. So, but for the beaked whales, it's a huge issue because they're diving for 45 minutes. You might go right over the top of them and never see them, right?
So I'll have to consult with you later about my whale tour business and how to start it, because it seems challenging.
Bait. I think bait is
bait.
Key. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So it's different at different parts of the year and different locations. You can definitely see certain seasons, you'll get a lot more clicks than other seasons when it's really quiet and nobody's really there. And it's just about when they're following prey, really. You know, they're looking for food. And so when the water's warm, maybe for these pantropical spotted dolphins, they come up from Mexico and follow their prey, whatever little fish or is their favorite. They're following it up into that water mass, and that's when we start to hear a whole bunch of them. And then it gets cold and winter comes and they, you know, go back down to the tropics following their little fish. It's really, so when you try and think about what drives animals being present, it's actually pretty well related to algae even. Like, the algae bloom and they're productive, and then the fish go eat the algae and the dolphins show up to eat the fish. Like,
the whole,
it's all a food web.
In Louisiana, where I am anyway, about how the river affects the Gulf, and or how any river or any delta from Matagorda to Pensacola affects that kind of algae production. Is there anything, or your research is a bit far away from that to see if there's any?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we do know about the algae, so you get this freshwater input with all the nitrogen that runs off the continent, right? And then you get a bunch of algae that bloom, and then they fall to the seafloor, and then you get a dead zone, right? Because you get these decaying algae. Well, a lot of sperm whales and beaked whales are feeding on things that would normally live in that dead zone. So you might see impacts there where
on the shelf.
They might not choose that area to forage in because the squid that they're eating isn't finding food. Mm-hmm. The fish don't want to be there. You know, it's all linked together.
It's all linked. Tell us about the Risso's.
Yeah, they're big dolphins. No, they're really cool. They look like a little old man. They don't really have a nose. They're really cute. But they're pretty big, and they're ocean-going, so they never come into shore. You really have to be offshore to see them. And they're bigger than your average, like, coastal bottlenose dolphin, maybe twice the size.
So coastal bottlenose, like, 7-8 feet.
Yeah,
dolphin
so you're talking, like, 3 meters, something.
Yeah, 3-4
meters.
Big. That's pretty big.
Yeah. And they like to hang out in groups, but not huge groups. It'll be, like, 10 to 15 animals, usually. Mm-hmm. And they have these really characteristic clicks, and we see them all over the world. The first place we saw them was in Southern California, and then when we came to put instruments in the Gulf, we're like, oh, here they are. They, you know, our friends that we can recognize. So, we've been seeing them. They're very seasonal in the Gulf of Mexico. They seem to come in just for the summer and then leave again. And they're big enough that they may be traveling in and out of the Atlantic. So there may be some connectivity between the Gulf of Mexico and the greater Atlantic with some of these species, and Risso's dolphin may be one of them.
Is this the first time that this technology has been used to track these species in the Gulf of Mexico? Yes.
Yeah, there hasn't
and
been.
Steadily, too.
Right.
This is 5 years of
work. It's been, we've tried really hard to keep the data set going, the time series going, because that's where you really get value, right? It's over a long period of time you get to the point where you can detect changes. If you only listen for a short period of time, you have no idea of what to compare to. What we're really, so our only other data point is the Exxon Valdez spill. And that was a much shallower spill, but there were orcas at that site. And what you saw, it really took about 10 years to see the effects of the oil spill on those animals. And there was one resident pod that lived right near the spill site that just after about 10 years you saw they just got completely decimated. Declined and eventually, you know, there's nobody there anymore. And so that's the time scale that we're trying to keep an eye on this population for, because kind of integrating over time, right? It's not like they eat something and then they're dead. You know, it's cumulative effects over a long period of time, and there's a recovery piece too, and it's a big area. Dolphins move around, so we really need a long time series to make sure that what we see is real, and that we have the data to back up long-term statements about what's happening.
Restoration of dolphin populations. How do you do it?
How do you do that? Exactly. Great question. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
coastal environmental advocates, they see that there are a tremendous amount of funding opportunities for different restoration projects, but because the government likes what it knows is the coast, and so even money is spent on open ocean restoration through something called the NERDA process, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment. Mm-hmm. I noticed that Gulf sturgeon they put it in the ocean pot.
Oh, really?
Even though I have to say probably the restoration for the sturgeon will involve dam removal on land.
Yeah.
So is that ocean?
Is that really ocean?
Is there a creep, away from funding restoration? What kinds of ocean restoration have you heard of in the past?
One thing that dolphins have going for them is that they're very mobile, right? And a lot of these species, like the talk John just gave, shows that they can leave an area if they want to, and we may have seen that. So I think restoration is more... it's more about coexistence with dolphins in the habitat. A lot of things that affect dolphins are just chronic things that could be improved, like noise pollution is a huge issue, including, the air guns. And we've seen that just the noise levels in the Gulf of Mexico are out of control. They're the highest we've seen anywhere in the world. So between that and shipping, you see that by slowing down boats, you can do some really nice, you can really help with greenhouse gas emission and noise. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that a little bit in Southern California. We've seen that up in the right whale areas of the North Coast. Yeah, they've done some good stuff. So it's about reducing the chronic impacts.
It seems like the government will end up hoping that restoring marshes in Louisiana, well, a great thing for me in New Orleans.
Right.
We're hoping that then that leads to more plankton and more little fish that eat the big fish, and the whales come
and
eat the squid that eat the big fish.
And anytime there's a marine reserve, those all combine to improve things. So I think every little bit definitely is helpful.
Kate Frazier, thanks so much for talking.
Well, thanks for talking to me. I'm glad. Thanks for your interest. Yeah.